As the tools for producing and sharing music become increasingly universal, a new passion towards shorter songs is emerging. But what's driving that change? In this episode of the Buster Mungus Diaries, we'll take a look at that change and how it's affecting your music consumption.
You're listening to the Buster Mungus Diaries, the people, places, and parallels in modern sound.
You're listening to the Buster Mungus Diaries podcast, Season 2, Episode 2, and I'm your host, Buster Mungus. When I was around 12 years old, I sort of awakened to the idea that art existed all around. And really specifically, I wanted to know more about certain aspects or certain groups or artists. And I started carrying a notebook around that I used solely for the purpose of recording my interests. So the next time I go to the library, I might look up that group or that artist and see what existed about them, any background information. Who did they like? Who did they copy? Who did they influence? And write that down. And essentially what you do is you end up getting a great big knowledge base of things that interest you. And that really becomes important as you get older and your memory fails you. But as a young person, it was a great way for me to explore art in general. More specifically, I kept doing that journaling activity for the rest of my life, and I still do it today, except I keep it electronically on an iPhone. But I came across a bunch of these old journals when I was doing some house cleaning, and I started to peek into them and look at the lists that I'd created and the notes that I'd jotted down when I was a kid. And really, I was amazed at how articulate I was, but also how involved I was in seeking out all this information. So as time went by, I grew these top 10 lists or these expansive continuous lists of certain types of music that I was interested in. A lot of the time, I would simply be interested, for example, in Delta blues, and I might go deep into that subject matter for weeks on end and then walk away from it. But after doing all the research and work and jotting down the notes, I had this great reservoir of information that was really tuned to the way I think. Now, the funny thing is, I still do the same journaling activity today, except I keep it on my iPhone and my laptop, and it's in a neat little database, so it's easy to kind of jump in and find information or add to it and move on. Whereas with the notebooks, you might have to flip through 100 pages to find something you remembered or wanted to find out. What really fascinated me about looking at these old journals was how in-depth I got with keeping lists and inquiries into new music, styles, genre, etc. You know, just overall music. And this really, actually for me, paid off because I was a club DJ during high school and university years, and that led me into radio after I graduated. I actually worked in a couple of radio stations where you got to actually program the music that was played each hour of your show. This doesn't happen anymore. It's all done through a corporate programming director who dictates what music gets played on a radio station, when it gets played, and who plays it at what time of the day. Back in the late 70s and the early 80s, it wasn't always the case. Small AM radio stations couldn't afford to have a program director in a lot of cases, and they relied upon the DJ themselves to do the programming of the show, that is, picking out the music and making sure that it fit in to the schedule of commercials, public service announcements, news, and weather broadcasts. And if you worked in campus or community radio, you also got to program your entire show. So it really had a lot of freedom at your fingertips as a disc jockey. And how does this all tie together? Those books of lists that I used to keep as a kid became the ammunition, if you will, for each of my radio shows. It allowed me to build shows that contained foreground programming. And that really means programming that is thematic in some way. Something you'll listen to and you might actually learn something. Just not a rolling format, which on the other hand is just playing a continuous stream of music that doesn't tie into any theme whatsoever. So how does that relate to our show today? Well, it really relates directly because I became really fascinated with a lot of types of music, but I really became fascinated and curious about short songs. And I don't mean joke songs or humorous little ditties. I mean actually well-formed, well-produced, well-sung and played songs. And that brings us to today's episode, which is the joy of the two-minute pop song. Since the late 1800s, we've been recording music on basically what we consider to be flat discs. And those discs have changed over the years in terms of the material that's been used, but they're basically the same thing. They're an analog representation of an audio signal. What I really find curious is that in all the time that we've had recorded music, the average length of a pop song is about 3 minutes. Before we get any deeper into the two-minute pop song, let's first take a look at a couple of definitions. And the most important one is defining what popular music is. Really, it's music that has a wide appeal and is typically distributed amongst large audiences within a society. But not all societies are identical, so pop music changes from location to location, regardless of what you might expect. Everywhere in the world does have its own form of pop music. For the context of this episode, we're going to deal with strictly the North American form of popular music from the 1940s until 2021. And that doesn't exclude other English-speaking nations. It just happens to be based on the tastes of the North American market during that 70 or 80 year period. And we really have to take a look at things creatively because after 70 years of pop music evolution, we have new norms evolving every day. And we might have started out with rock and roll in the 1950s or R&B and jump blues in the 1940s, but now pop music is dominated by perhaps the greatest strength in pop music, which is hip-hop. Pop music continuously changes and evolves, and it reflects society and the changes that are taking place there as well. One of the things that piqued my curiosity when doing the research for this episode was seeing that really every 10 years or so, pop music gets upended, turned around, and it kind of reimagines itself and evolves into something else as the tastes of the public change. The change in tastes are societal, economic, or technological for the most part. And when those things start to interplay with each other, we get developments that make tastes change. And it's not necessarily driven by any one of those three things. One of the key definitions behind pop music is really the length of the song. And that's what we're talking about today. Over time, pop music typically runs about 3 minutes in length. But not every song, you know, really fits that mold. Some are shorter, like the ones we're going to talk about today, and others are longer. And that's when you're talking about groups like Led Zeppelin or Pink Floyd. And they made their names on long and complicated and intricate songs, but that's a whole different animal. Somehow, though, since the 1940s, and actually earlier than the 1940s, but for the case of this episode, we're going to deal with 1940 to 2021, the pop song has remained at a 3 minute mark on average. So that means on a bell curve, that's smack dab in the middle at the peak of the bell curve. Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin are to the right, and shorter songs that we're talking about today are on the left side of the curve. So before you grab your phone and start emailing me and telling me there's no way possible that the average pop song is 3 minutes in length, let me tell you how we did the research. We use the Billboard and Cashbox magazine's top 100 pop song lists for each year. And then we downloaded the entire musicbrainz.com database, which they make publicly available for anybody to use, extracted all the metadata for those songs, dropped them into an Excel spreadsheet, and then averaged out the length of time for each of those pop songs. And I'm telling you, it comes to just slightly over 3 minutes on average for 80 to 90 years worth of popular music. So the idea is we're going to take a look at the technology aspect of music and see how it has constrained pop music over time. And the best place to start with that is to look at the recording medium that has been used over those 100 plus years. Now, if you're old enough, you'll remember vinyl records like it was yesterday. If you're younger, you call them vinyls, and they cost a fortune today, but they don't sound any better than they did 40 years ago. It's the medium that turns out to be the real limiting factor in this story. So let's take a look. In the late 1800s, we began recording music on flat discs, and those are called 78s by vinyl enthusiasts and collectors. And it's called that because the record actually spins at 78 revolutions per minute. The 78 disc severely limits the length a song can actually be because only so much music can fit on the disc. Now, the 78 RPM records come in two sizes. The most popular and recognizable is the 10-inch disc, and that holds 3 minutes of music, while the 12-inch version of the 78 RPM record is more rare, but it holds 4 minutes of music. And that's important to understand when figuring out the problem associated with why pop music has been limited to 3 minutes. Now, recordings had been made earlier than that, but they were on cylinders. Some were shellac, some were wax, with the equivalent of today would be tinfoil wrapped around it. And a needle follows the grooves in that cylinder and is amplified by a horn. So you see those big pictures of old Victrolas. They had a big horn on them, and that's where the sound came from. Today, we really think of a record as being something that contains only music. But originally, the cylinders that were recorded were done so as a transcription method, and in some cases were recorded just to prove that it could actually be done. Music was not the push or the driving force behind the invention of the recording device. And that may shock some people. Music came later. It really wasn't anything more than a purpose-made dictaphone at the time. Although it gave permanence to the human voice, they really weren't that popular. They were expensive and hellishly delicate. And some of the wax cylinders, if you stored them in a room that was too warm, they would disintegrate, just like a candle does when it gets warm. The wax melts. The shellac is more permanent, but it's incredibly noisy. It's not a surface that lends itself to silence. The recording techniques were often crude and really basic. Before 1925, all 78s recorded were done by the artist singing into a big speaking horn and the power of the voice directly vibrating the recording stylus and thus cutting the wax of the master disc. Collectors tend to call these discs acoustic recordings. So really the acoustical era was 1877 to 1925. And the earliest methods of recording are often described as acoustical and employ only mechanical means for both recording and playback of the disc. The sounds to be preserved are directed into a large horn, which is at its tapered end, a connection to a cutting stylus. In response to the vibrations from the air in the horn, the stylus cuts a spiral groove in the thick wax coating of a cylinder or disc. The cutting process creates variations in the groove analogous to the varying frequency and the amplitude of the vibrations. So the stylus really moves up and down in a hill and dale fashion, while at the same time moving left to right or horizontally, cutting what look like waves into the shellac or wax. The funny thing is, acoustical recordings never yielded anything close to what we call high fidelity, and its dynamic range was so limited that distortion was often a problem. From 1925 to 1947 is really considered the electrical era. Not electronic, but electrical. And the first electrical recording was issued in 1925. And the term electrical recording is normally used as a contraindication in opposition to acoustical recording. And the term electrical recording is not really used after the introduction of magnetic tape in 1947. So how did we get sound onto the record in an electrical fashion? Well, recordings of the sounds to be preserved were gathered by a transducer, a microphone in common terms, and the vibrations are then converted into a varying electrical signal, which is amplified and then applied to another transducer, which is the stylus, which cuts a spiral groove in a waxed or later lacquered disc, which is then mass-produced as a 78 RPM record. To get a better idea and a bigger picture of the whole recording process, up until the point in time where we get into the electronic era of recorded music, head on over to BusterMungus.com and look at the show notes for this episode, The Joy of the Two-Minute Pop Song. And from there, you can ride the links to all of these pages and really get a better understanding of what we're talking about. One of the drawbacks, however, to the 78 RPM record is that they're fragile, meaning that the shellac will easily break if they're mishandled. Another problem with 78 RPM records is they were expensive to make, and shellac, during World War II, actually became a restricted commodity, so record producers began looking elsewhere. Perhaps the greatest drawback was that the 78 RPM record was limited to 3 minutes of music. You couldn't squeeze anything else onto that 10-inch platter. And that's how we get to the first era of pop music being limited to roughly 3 minutes in length. It wasn't until the 1950s when a thing called sound-alikes hit the scene. And really what they are remakes, cover songs in the parlance of the music business, if you will, except that they're not interpretations or creative variations on the original song, but they're deemed to be carbon copies. These remakes aren't motivated by artistry or desire to do something new. They're really driven by the almighty cash. Sound-alikes are a completely mercenary venture. The whole goal is to duplicate the original song in every respect, and I mean down to the smallest sound, using studio musicians and vocalists, in an effort to lure consumers into listening and buying these sound-alike recordings. However, sharp listeners really notice the difference within a few seconds. But on the other hand, a whole hell of a lot of people don't care and won't understand the difference. And that's the whole point of sound-alikes. So what do sound-alikes have to do with the 78 RPM record or the joy of the 3-minute song? The practice of sound-alikes doesn't exist solely for the benefit of shady record producers or production companies working in the margins of the music ecosystem who are looking to make easy money from a pre-existing hit. Keep in mind that this is a very old game. And well into the 1940s and 50s, it was not uncommon to have up to a half a dozen versions of a single song by a slew of artists on any of the charts at the same time. In the late 1940s, a guy by the name of Carl Dosche founded a company called Topps Records in 1947. And then in 1950, he had this brilliant idea, and I mean it's brilliant. Since he was well acquainted with the consumer demand for hit songs at the time, he really decided to make some of his own by simply copying them. And using LA-based session players, he recorded almost identical sounding versions of tunes by the likes of Hank Williams, Frankie Lane, and Pat Boone. But while normal hits would go for 79 or 99 cents a record at the time, he undercut the market by charging only 39 cents per record. And almost immediately, his whole idea and scheme took off. Topps Records took their commitment to saving a buck seriously, even figuring out how to squeeze an extra song on each side of a 78 RPM record, with their marketing plan of 4 hits on each record. And it screamed that on every label of the 78 RPM records that they produced. So how did they do this? How did they squeeze 4 songs onto a 78 RPM record when songs at the time were really just about 3 minutes in length? Carl Dosche and his engineers figured out a way to squeeze the extra minutes of songs into the cutting of each record that they made. Not only did they rip off artists and completely redo their songs, they edited the songs down so that they were shorter, number one, and number two, they used a technique for cutting the vinyl that basically took out the bass and reduced the volume, which meant that the grooves could be narrower. And with grooves that were smaller and narrower, you could physically put more on a 78 RPM record. Nobody had done this before. So let's take a step back and look at this again. They reduced the length of a song, and quite simply, it would have been beneficial for them to shorten each track as much as possible, getting songs down to as close to the 2-minute or under mark. They would miss a verse, shorten the number of choruses, and at the end, make the fade out really quick, not like we know it today. It would almost drop off. It would be so fast. Cutting a 78 RPM record, it's really down to the sheer size of the needle, the type of medium, in this case, the shellac 78 RPM record, and the volume of the recording. So if you remember the KTEL records when you're kids, they always seemed very low and without bass, and that's the trick that Carl Dosche invented. They could apply a simple EQ curve, turn down the bass, as bass requires larger movement in the groove than treble does, and that would further reduce the width of a track. We've got some links on BusterMungus.com in the show notes for this episode that'll take you to a link that basically describes, in somewhat layman's terms, how the cutting of a record takes place and the physics behind it, if you really need to know. If you're searching for records, finding a four hits on each record from Topps Records is an incredible find. Although they sold hundreds of thousands of these things, they really didn't survive. People didn't seem to find them collectible until recently, and they're very hard to locate. But once you have one, you can actually physically see how the grooves are not as deep and not as wide. It's a really interesting approach to things. And the music, it's secondary. It's not really the strong point that Topps Records focused on. And many of the songs, although they were sound-alikes, also had lyrics that were sound-alikes. So instead of Black Slacks, somebody would record a song called Black Denim Jeans. And I guess that's really one way of getting around sort of the copyright infringement aspect of the sound-alike record. Let's take a moment now, and we'll listen to one of the earliest Topps Records productions called Black Denim Trousers. And while Topps used really top-flight musicians and really state-of-the-art recording studios for the time period, getting that quality onto the shellac didn't really translate into a long-lasting audio quality, if you will. By reducing the volume and removing a lot of the bass in the records, Topps Records were prone to surface noise and distortion. Black Denim Trousers by Ken Otte is transferred actually from one of my own copies that I got about 20 years ago. And it's on a 10-inch 78 RPM shellac record. One of the horrible things about transcribing a 78 RPM record is finding out basically what is the width of the track at the present time, because different recording studios use different depths and widths, and there was no standard. And then you have to factor in how many times this record was played on a Victrola or anything with an improper needle. So the result is, I tried about a half a dozen different 78 RPM styluses in order to get the sound that you're going to hear from Ken Otte, and it's gone through a digital audio workstation to clean up as much of the noise as possible, but it's not perfect. Take a listen. This will give you an idea what was being produced in the 1950s on Topps Record, sort of the KTEL of the day. And as a side note, I've scoured every resource available to me online and in person, and I've been unable to locate any real information about the singer. Ken Otte seems to be a mystery everywhere. What we do know from Music Brains and Discogs and a couple of other sources is that his output was limited and seemed to be confined to Topps Records before he disappeared and did nothing else in the industry.
Trousers and motorcycle boots and a black leather jacket with an eagle on the back. He had a hot tub circle that took off like a gun. That fool was the terror of Highway 101. Well, he never washed his face and he never combed his hair. He had axle grease embedded underneath his fingernails. On the muscle of his arm was a red tattoo, a picture of a heart saying, "Mother, I love you." He had a pretty girlfriend by the name of Mary Lou, but he treated her just like he treated all the rest. And everybody pitied her, cause everybody knew he loved that doggone motorcycle best. He wore black denim trousers and motorcycle boots and a black leather jacket with an eagle on the back. He had a hopped up circle that took off like a gun. That fool was a terror of Highway 101. Mary Lou. Poor girl, she pleaded and she begged him not to leave. She said, I got a feeling if you're right tonight, I'll grieve. But her tears were shed in vain and her empty words was lost in the rumble of his engine and the smoke from his exhaust. He took off like a devil, there was fire in his eyes. He said, I'll go 1,000 miles before the sun can rise. But he hit a screaming diesel that was California bound. And when they cleared the wreckage, all they found was black denim trousers and motorcycle boots and a black leather jacket with an eagle on the back. But they couldn't find a circle that took off like a gun, and they never found a tear of Highway 101.
While radio had been with us since the 1920s, it really wasn't until the 1950s when advertising, marketing, sales, promotion, all of those things came together and forced a change in the format of radio. The format evolved into as many songs as possible within a given hour. And what do I mean by that? Well, a certain part of each hour of radio is taken up with basic common things. The news, weather reports, commercials, station jingles and IDs, and public service announcements. And so that doesn't leave a whole hell of a lot of time for music, if you consider that the average disc jockey opens up the mic and talks or plays one of these segments every 15 minutes of an hour. So it really gives you about 12 minutes per hour to play music. So if I go from playing two or three songs in every 15-minute section to playing four, five, or six songs within that 12-minute allotment, I keep my audience happy because they want variety. They want a constant change in the music they're listening to, not to mention that they also want hit songs. They want to hear what's popular. And this is what drove Carl Dosche to invent the four songs on a 78 RPM record. Make them short, get in, get out, please an audience, and add value. So we really can hail Carl Dosche as the originator of the two-minute pop song. Now let's go back to radio for a second. Early in my career, after graduating university, I went into radio. And one of the things that you become acutely aware of is time. As I mentioned before, you've got commercials, weather, public service announcements. All these things have to happen at a certain time, leaving you with four segments to play music. So you become acutely aware of that time and what needs to fit into it. In the world of AM radio, back in the late 70s, early 80s, many small stations couldn't afford to have disc jockeys and a separate programmer position. And what's a radio programmer? That's the person that decides when all of this stuff gets played, how it gets played, when it gets played. In a lot of small stations, you, the disc jockey, were your own programmer. And that was one of the joys of working in a small station at the time. Now, that's not to forget that FM radio around the same time was coming into its own. Had had two or three decades of DJs programming their own music because the rules were a little looser and the FM broadcasting dial was not as popular as AM, so they had a bit of latitude into what they played. So getting back to the time issue, all these journals that I'd kept since I was a teenager came in handy because they had lists of songs, and a lot of the lists comprised of what I thought were really neat sub-2-minute songs. So I was able to use that knowledge to best fit and craft a set of songs for each 15-minute segment that I had in front of me for the duration of my radio show. And that's how I evolved into having a real penchant for a 2-minute pop song.
Quart of oil, a gallon of gas, baby, I sure do hope it lasts. Destination love, destination love. If I get stuck, give me a shove. Destination love, I can't wait to see her smile. Only got about 10 more miles. Destination love, destination love. If I get stuck, give me a shove. Destination love. Well, I pass the truck, pass the bus, I must be doing fine. I'm so close I can almost feel her sweet lips on mine. If the front tire blows, I got a spare. If that one goes, I'll still get there. Destination love, destination love. If I get stuck, give me a shove. It only steamed up twice. If this old car goes one more mile, I'll be in paradise. She'll be waiting, there I know. Left turn, right turn, here I go. Destination love, destination love. If I get stuck, give me a shove. Destination love.
From 1956, Winoni Harris with Destination Love, clocking in at a wonderful 1 minute and 30 seconds in length, making it one of my favorite all-time sub-2-minute pop songs. With World War II over and supply chains getting back into the swing of things, the previous shortage in shellac had really led a lot of development into alternative materials, and that would eventually give birth to what we call vinyl. Now, with the coming of the vinyl age in the late 1940s, that evolutionary trend continued, and RCA Victor had nearly gone bust in the 1930s trying to develop what they called a long playing record, what we just simply call vinyl or records today. But RCA eventually came up with the invention of what we know as the 45 RPM 7-inch single that would rival the 78 RPM disc that we've been used to up until that point in time. In 1949, RCA introduced a 45 RPM disc that quickly, and I mean quickly, overtook the 78 RPM disc and made the 78s obsolete. These 45s were better sounding than 78s in numerous ways, but they were made out of vinyl instead of shellac, which made them more durable and essentially more portable because they're thinner and smaller. They were also really cheap to make and to purchase. They drove down the cost of the single, just as Carl Dosche had done with his four tops on a record, and this made them easy to market to teenagers. Like 78s, the 45 also holds about 3 minutes of music, and that really depends on the range of the song required and the depth of the groove in the disc, as we talked about earlier with Carl Dosche's technique. A key feature of the 45 that everybody notices when they see it is that the hole in the center is about 10 times larger than the hole on an LP record. And that initially was seen as a differentiator, but it also meant that they couldn't play those records on a Victrola, which was kind of the most popular record player in existence up until the end of World War II. This meant technology had to evolve again, so you'll see record players that came with adapters that fit over the spindle so you could stack 45 RPM records, say 7 to 10 of them, and as each one played through, the automatic return on the tone arm would trigger a gear and drop the next record down. So you could get probably half an hour worth of music out of your 45 RPM collection without having to touch the turntable. Although we got a lighter, cheaper, smaller, and more affordable recording medium with the 45 RPM record, we were also still limited to roughly 3 minutes of music per side. We really hadn't changed the playing field technologically from the 78 RPM record. Sure, they sounded good and were cheaper, but we didn't expand the capability of the artist to write and perform longer pieces of music. Thankfully, everything coming together in the 1950s allowed artists to actually produce short songs that met the requirements of radio and teenagers all at the same time. And perhaps one of the greatest examples of this is Jerry Lee Lewis's Great Balls of Fire, coming in at an amazing minute and 52 seconds of just pure pounding rock and roll.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain. Too much of love drives a man insane. You broke my will, but what a thrill. Goodness gracious, great balls of fire. I let you love what I thought it was funny. You came along and woo, now honey, I've changed my mind. This love is fine. Great balls of fire. Kisses, baby. Feels good. Hold me, baby. Well, I want to love you like I love a shoe. You're fine. So kind. Got to tell this world that you're mine. I chew my nails and then I twiddle my thumb. I'm real nervous, but it sure is fun. Come on, baby. It drives me crazy. It's just great balls of fire.
Great like to love us just. You're fine, so kind. Got to tell this world that you might need a chew on the hill that I quit on my thumb. Real nice, somebody show him fun. Come on, baby, drive crazy.
Perhaps the greatest sub-2-minute song ever recorded. That was Great Balls of Fire, recorded by Jerry Lee Lewis, obviously on Sun Records, and featured in the 1957 movie Jamboree. It was originally written by Otis Blackwell and a guy named Jack Hammer, believe it or not. This Jerry Lee Lewis recording was ranked as the 96th greatest song ever by Rolling Stone.
You're listening to the Buster Mungus Diaries with your host, Buster Mungus.
With the desire of teenagers to have constant variety on the radio and on their turntable, the drive to create short songs was in full swing. And at this point, Topps Records started to produce 4 songs on a 45 RPM record. These are rare and very hard to find, but they illustrate trying to force old technology into the new medium. In reality, artists just got better at writing shorter songs. During this period in the 1950s, we start to see the emergence of really well-crafted, short, sub-3-minute songs, as well as the emergence of the 2-minute pop song, or thereabouts. And one of the great things about these new, shorter songs was that they were still great rock and roll songs. They didn't lose anything in the translation.
Baby, let me be your love and teddy bear. Put a chain around my neck and lead me anywhere. Let me be,
oh, let him be
your teddy bear. I don't want to be a tiger, cause tigers play too rough. I don't want to be a lion, cause lions ain't the kind you love enough. But as I wanna be your teddy bear, put a chain around my neck and leave me anywhere. Oh, let me be,
oh, let him be
your teddy bear. Baby, let me be around you every night. Run your fingers through my hair and cuddle me real tight. Oh, let me be,
oh, let him be
your teddy bear. I don't want to be your tiger, cause tigers play too rough. I don't want to be a lion, cause lions ain't the kind you love enough. Cause I wanna be your teddy bear. Put a chain around my neck and leave me anywhere. Oh, let me be,
oh, let him be
your teddy bear. Oh, let me be,
oh, let him be your teddy bear.
I just wanna be your teddy bear.
From 1957, Elvis Presley with Teddy Bear. And by this time, short songs had started to become more mainstream and more accepted by the general public as radio tended to play the hell out of them. Instead of just playing a song once or twice a day, they might play it 2 or 3 times in an hour. Teddy Bear was recorded in 1957 for the soundtrack of his second motion picture, Loving You. And during the movie, Elvis Presley performs the song on screen. So you get a double whammy. You get radio coverage and film coverage. You couldn't ask for anything better. While the 2-minute pop song was really invented in the 1950s by Carl Dosche, it was the 1960s where everything came together in a perfect mixture. Radio stations wanted to play more songs, teenagers wanted to hear more songs, and disc jockeys were there to do it. But the problem for disc jockeys was, if you play so much music, there's no time left for the disc jockey to introduce the songs or tell you anything about the artists. As a result, disc jockeys resorted to talking over the introduction of songs, which we take for granted today when we listen to the radio. But before the 1950s, it was sacrilege to talk over any music being played, whether it was live or recorded. So this meant a big shift in how stations programmed their music. This led to several things happening. In the record world, you would get the album cut the 45, and special radio edits. And the radio edit versions were usually much shorter than the album and or the 45 versions, so that radio could again slip in perhaps another song every hour, which meant more listenership, more revenue through advertising, and a greater listening audience. During this period, technology is going crazy. The invention of the transistor and its popularization through miniature radios and car stereos would provide an opportunity, you'd think, to allow the pop song to grow in length beyond the 3-minute mark. And that created a whole new genre of music, or the capability for genres of music, because you had up to 23.5 minutes on each side of a 33 RPM record. However, that didn't affect radio airplay, and it didn't change the length of a pop song. At this point, we're still hindered by the 3-minute limit of the 45 RPM record, which is a carryover from the limit of the 78 RPM record. And it won't be until the 1980s when we see the ability for the pop song to grow in length. Choosing the perfect 2-minute pop song from the 1960s is a really hard job. There are hundreds of them that are fabulous, but I've chosen two that I think illustrate sort of polar opposites of the 1960s. First song we heard was the Beatles' Please Please Me from their 1963 release, and it clocks in at 2 minutes and 1 second. And this still qualifies for a 2-minute pop song because we can attribute the fade out to a few seconds, which would tip this under 2 minutes. And you got to remember, in early 1963, pop acts were still releasing 3-minute 45 RPM singles and occasionally 4-song EPs. The long player or album was usually beyond the fiscal reach of most teenagers, and the LP was an art form that really hadn't yet emerged. And albums tended to be just a handful of hits and selected songs to fill up or bulk up the extra space on an album. The Beatles used a 2-track BTR recording machine, and it left little opportunity for overdubs or elaborate arrangements for this cut. And BTR, for those who don't know, stands for British Tape Recorders. It was a manufacturer at the time. And I love Please Please Me partly because of its innocence, and partly because in retrospect, I know that when the group were recording this album, which was in fact a collection of songs from their live act, little could they have truly have envisioned the effect that they would have on the world, on popular music and culture, as well as the technical innovations that would come from all their work. Right after that, we heard the sort of arch nemesis of the Beatles, the Beach Boys, with their song Shutdown, also from 1963, clocking in at a solid 1:50. Shutdown was originally written by Brian Wilson for the Beach Boys, and on March 4th, 1963, it was released as the B-side to their smash single, Surfin' USA. The concept of a drag race between two cars is the story of speed and time, which are usually reflected in the song's length, while modern drag races are stories of just a handful of seconds over 1,250 feet. Early drag racing was never so precise and relied more upon who crossed the finish line first. But the essence is the same, shortest time wins. And Capitol Records released it again later that year on the album Little Deuce Coupe, and the single peaked at 23 on the US Billboard Hot 100 chart. But barring the success of both those groups in American pop music, perhaps the greatest sub-2-minute pop song to ever hit number one on the Billboard's charts is The Letter by the Box Tops, released in 1967 and coming in at a minuscule 1:53. This song's been recorded by more than 180 artists since 1967. The Letter should be a sloppy and amateurish record and wouldn't necessarily prevent it from being great, but The Letter's not that. It's a 2-minute epic. One reason this record was or is so good: the players were all top Memphis Muscle Shoals guys like Spooner Oldham, Reggie Young, David Hood. And these guys played with Wilson Pickett, Aretha Franklin, Dusty Springfield, just to name a few. These were top-notch guys. And when you top that off with Alex Chilton's vocal and a great song like this, it couldn't fail. The Letter is a tight, hard, compact piece of white kid soul. It's the last number one song ever to come in under the 2-minute mark, but it really sounds big and cinematic. With Chilton's voice fighting its way through the nervous organs and the melodramatic strings and horn stabs, the verse, there's really only one verse, sounds like a chorus, and the chorus sounds like the world ending. There's nothing lo-fi about this record. Even if it was recorded on a low budget, it's got the sweep of a James Bond theme. But all that production never drowns out the fervish urgency of the song, and it never muffles Chilton's voice. I give you The Letter by the Box Tops from 1967.
Got to get back to my baby again. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. When she wrote me a letter, said she couldn't live without me no more. Listen, mister, can't you see I got to get back to my baby once more.
yeah. Got me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. The only days are gone, I'm a going home. My baby sister wrote me a letter. When she wrote me a letter, said she couldn't live without me no more. Listen, mister, can't you see I got to get back to my baby once more. Anyway, yeah, got me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby sister wrote me a letter. My baby sister wrote me a letter.
Visit www.bustermungus.com for more information.
As the 70s approached, you'd think that technology would then take another step and would have a different effect on the length of pop song. In actuality, two things happened. We got longer songs and we got shorter songs. How did this happen? Really, we got the album. This is the heyday of the single, double, and triple LP albums. And that allowed musicians to, in some cases, ramble on beyond their talent as they created these grandiose ideas of what they thought music should be. And on the other hand, it allowed some artists to really put together a beautiful artistic interpretation of what they were thinking about. But we're more concerned with the shorter end of things. And that's where punk comes in. Punk really did a number on how people viewed the short song. So as a kid who grew up during punk's emergence, it's not like I'm new to the short song thing, because so many punk bands were really the masters of brevity. You need to look up this guy, David Ensminger, and his book, Visual Vitriol, because he sums it up really nicely by saying punk music was built on the back of 3 chords and 2-minute songs and minimal guitar solos. And never were more wise words said, because in order to get a song down to 2 minutes, you've got to give things up. That just happened to be one of the ethos of punk music, was its brevity and its lack of solos, because solos up until this time had just been the ramblings of a lot of artists who really thought they were better than they really were. And not all punk music was short. Don't be fooled. But by and large, the idea was to convey the feeling and move on to the next thing. Nobody embraced this more than the Ramones, whose favorite music just happened to be all of these short songs from the 1960s. That was the basis for everything they did.
You're listening to the Buster Mungus Diaries with your host, Buster Mungus.
It wasn't until 1979 when Philips invented the CD, or the compact disc, And that's the next big technological change that might have had some effect on how we consumed music. No longer were hits solely dependent upon the limitations of a 45 RPM record. You now had a format that allowed an artist 60 minutes of creativity. No longer were songs limited to the 23 minutes per side of a record. You had a full 60 minutes if you wanted it. But this really did very little to change the actual length of pop songs. It's a pain in the ass to do, but as we told you earlier, you can retrieve all of this great information from musicbrains.org. And when we looked at it all and broke it down by decades, we saw that the biggest jump, according to this data, was between the 1960s and the 1980s. And then very little changed from the 1990s until the present day. When we talk about the song increasing in length over time, we're not talking about minutes. It didn't go from 3 minutes to 6 minutes or 7 minutes. We're talking about seconds. Songs increased on average by seconds between the late 1960s and the mid-1980s, at which point we started to see a drop-off and a return to the roughly three-minute-long pop song. What we couldn't anticipate was a change as radical as technology had given us with the birth of digital music and the internet. The internet did a couple of things for music. Most immediately, piracy. Napster was a huge hit in the late 90s. Everybody was downloading from it. Music seemed to be free. We had a culture that now assumed that music was free for the taking from any source on the internet. This did more damage than home taping did in the 70s and 80s when people would buy an album and record it onto cassette for their car. This was outright theft. There was no original purchase or original ownership of the music. People were simply downloading music that they thought was free. Skip ahead a few years and we get into Apple iTunes, where music is provided for a fee electronically for the first time. In an organized and professional fashion that becomes popular. Apple iTunes emerges as really the kingpin of music distribution and getting artists money for their songs. Shortly thereafter, this whole concept of subscribing to a service where the music is streamed to you over the internet, so you don't have to have a record collection any longer. You simply pull up an app, tap on a button, and the music comes through the internet, however you get your internet, and directly to your device. This is almost as big a disruption to the music world as radio was in the early 1920s. This changed the paradigm of how we consume artistic endeavors that are related to music. It really turns the whole thing on its head once again. Now, streaming pays nothing to the artist by comparison to actually purchasing their song or buying their merchandise. So go ahead, go to your favorite band's websites, buy their albums online, and buy their merch, for God's sake. And even better, go see them and do it there. But streaming has become a force. But streaming has become a parallel universe to radio. Streaming and radio are in some ways living in parallel universes, both fighting for listenership. As streaming becomes more popular, radio pays the price for it. Listenership drops. Currently, you really have to look hard to find an AM radio station. And quite frankly, why would you want to? The sound is horrible. That's why it's relegated to talk radio and religious stations. The quality is horrible. When on the other hand, you could take an iPhone and have perfect studio quality music pumped through your AirPods and be in a whole other world. So what about FM radio? That was supposed to be the brave new wave, the future of broadcasting for people. FM radio really solely exists for those people in their cars driving to work. It really provides no other service. Streaming, on the other hand, is just as available and offers you selection that you could never have before. You don't have to have 100 cassettes in your car. You don't have to have 100 CDs flopping around all over the front seat on your car anymore. You can actually stream from your telephone to your car stereo and listen to anything you want. That gives you the possibility of 70 to 100 million songs at your fingertips at any point in time. Why would you listen to the FM stations? In order to try and compete, these great big conglomerates are buying up FM radio stations by the dozen and converting them to a point where you may have a morning guy live for your area, but the rest of the day's programming is all done through a central hub somewhere and distributed to 100 or 200 radio stations across the country. So that if you're driving across the country, you can hear the same shit in different places by the same company. It's a horrible distribution model, and it's killing jobs and killing creativity in the field of radio broadcasting. So what are people doing? They're turning to streaming because they can get 70 to 100 million songs on their device at any point in time. Streaming giants like Apple and Spotify are turning into the new radio stations. And what's happening is they're dictating the length of a song based on the listener's requirements. If we go back to the 1950s, what did teenagers want then? They wanted more variety and they wanted more songs in the same amount of time. Let's go back to that again. They want more songs in the same amount of time. That's key. That's what drove the change for radio in the 1950s. And that's what's happening in the 2020s. We're seeing a return to short songs for a couple of reasons, and one of them is the Spotify factor. So in just under 2 months in 2018, I Love It by Kanye West and Lil Pimp garnered over 200 million streams on Spotify, 270 million views on YouTube, and it stayed in the Hot 100 Billboard charts for 6 weeks. The song is just 2 minutes and 7 seconds long. Compared to Kanye West's other top 20 performing Billboard hits, which are all at least 3 minutes in length, I Love It is exceptionally brief. You barely have time to digest the insanity before the track's over. On the whole, songs are getting a lot shorter because of this. And this just isn't because of SoundCloud rappers like Lil Pimp, whose hits have been consistently short since the beginning of their career. The median length of Billboard Hot 100 songs has dropped over 30 seconds since 2000. Over the last few years, the number of songs in the Hot 100 under 2.5 minutes has gone from 1% to close to 10% by 2020. That's a huge increase. So what the hell happened? Well, in 2015, streaming overtook digital downloads as the music industry's biggest source of revenue in the United States, and it outstripped CD and digital download sales, and streaming has dominated ever since. By 2015, streaming accounted for just over a third of the revenue model, while in 2018, that number skyrocketed to 75%. During the whole process, many artists have seen the writing on the wall, if you will, and they've begun to adapt to the way their music is consumed, which is exactly what happened in the 1950s and early 60s. So, more streams make more money. That's pretty obvious. But even then, it's not a lot of money, which is why getting it played more often is crucial. 1 million streams on Spotify generates $7,000, as reported by CNBC. That's not a lot of money, considering that those artists, they really find that achievement daunting. To put it in another perspective, 99% of all streaming is dominated by just a core group of 10% of all artists. Since one stream typically earns the same amount of money for an artist, no matter what the length of the track, there's an incentive to create shorter songs so as to gain as many streams as possible. This is a total strategy to game the system. Besides the impact of streaming, short songs might just be part of an instant gratification culture of our digital age. And if you take a look, according to Time magazine, the average attention span for the notoriously ill-focused goldfish is 9 seconds. But according to a new study by Microsoft, people now generally lose concentration after 8 seconds, highlighting the effects of an increasingly digitized lifestyle on the brain. This really means we have an attention span of less than a goddamn goldfish. Variation of the audio is one solution. Listeners will more likely stay and listen through an entire album of short songs, which means that the next new track is never too far away. They can just be gratified almost instantly. By the time you get into the song, feel the groove, you're out of it. So if you think this is just a fad, or something that is going to come and go pretty quickly, I'm here to tell you differently. What drives what's heard on the radio is really an artist's desire to have their music hit the mainstream, and also a record label's desire to profit from that success. So Steve Jones, who's the vice president of a Canadian radio firm called Newcap, told NPR that Newcap, although a technology firm with offerings such as the music channels that you get on your TV, they also own radio stations in Canada. And they recently debuted top 40 stations that offer, get this, twice the music. Which really means it ends up cutting and editing songs to at least half their length to make them shorter. Now, as radical as that seems, Jones is on to something. Because the length of a song on an album doesn't matter for anybody except the artist and the fans. But for songs and songwriters that hope to make money from their endeavor, they need to be played on the radio, and they need to be played on the radio often. That's how they get paid. What it really boils down to for an artist is track length. The streaming model, just as popular radio did in the 1950s and 60s, has really disrupted the artist's process in many, many ways. It's making them reconsider their song length. Or perhaps they're feeling frustrated that song lengths can be so influential, or maybe it's that they can't entirely wrap their art around a specific song length. In the short term, though, the charts look like they will continue to exhibit this influence. But will this last if different music distribution models start to take off? What are those models? We don't know. That lies ahead of us, probably based a lot on technology. But what we do know is that songs are getting shorter and we're starting to enjoy the fact that we get instant gratification, we get variety, and we get what the brain needs, which is a quick fix. I'm your host, Buster Mungus, and I really want to take this time to thank you for listening. If you're looking for more information about the topic of today's episode, we've got an incredible amount of content for you at bustermungus.com. We've got curated playlists of some great and fabulous 2-minute songs. We've also got links to how vinyl became so important and how you cut a vinyl record. I know that's interesting to quite a few people. And we also have articles on just about each artist included in our curated playlist. If you've got iTunes or Spotify, those playlists can be downloaded into your account so that you can take them with you and listen wherever.
If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review at Apple Podcasts or Podchaser.com. To check out all the links and resources from the show, including show notes, curated playlists, and videos, head over to BusterMungus.com. To catch all the latest, you can follow us on Instagram at BusterMungus or on Facebook at BusterMungus Diaries. Thanks again for spending your time with us.